So if you're listening to this, that means you've had a week's gap from episode one, part one, which means that you've had a week where you've been wondering what on earth was going to be said next in the next pieces, wondering what other nuggets of information were coming from my guest. And you've had a week where you haven't been able to apply those nuggets because you didn't know they existed or what they were, which is a little bit frustrating, really, because imagine how much more efficient, productive, or amazing you could have been. But you know there's a way around it. You know that you can pop along to Patreon, www.patreon.com/SundayLunchPM, or to Spotify, have a look at the feed, and there's a little lock. Click on the lock and it'll ask you to pay. It's the price of a coffee. That's it. A month. And you'll get everything a week early. And you won't have bits like this in it with me wittering on about becoming a patron and things like that. So, have a think. And anyway, I'll shut up now because you're probably thinking, just get on with it, Nigel. So yeah, here's the second part of the show. So, I have a number of sponsors, affiliate links, in the way that it's set up, that have kindly allowed me to share their services, really. The first one is Mike Kling, and Mike runs PM, online PM courses, and it is a great resource for getting those fundamentals of project management trained, reasonably priced, and Mike presents it in an accessible and clear manner. You can check out some of his videos on his YouTube channel and kind of give you a view of where they are. But the code for that, if you go to nigelcreaser.com/onlinepmcourses, all one word, lowercase, that'll redirect you to it. There's varying different levels that you can buy. You can buy individual courses, you can buy pathways as well, if you like. And I get a kickback off those. Mike kindly shares me that. So if you do jump on and use it, I hope you find it really useful. I think he has money back guarantees and things like that as well. So there's a very limited risk on that. So jump on that, and that again is nigelcreaser.com/onlinepmcourses, and enjoy.
Yeah, and I think that whole thing about it was kind of a bit of a facetious. It doesn't matter what you do, you risk register to escalate up because they're being dealt with. But then when it goes, why didn't you have that on the risk? And it's kind of, well, it wasn't, I didn't see it as being a risk. I saw it as being a problem. I just needed to deal with it. If I read it, I'm doing it. So, and you get it wrong sometimes, don't you?
Yeah. I like scenario based, you know, thinking about what the failure could be. And a lot of that's going to be based on history. Now, the reason I came to that, when that PM came to me with the problem, you know, you're going to jump on this truck, your team's going to jump on this truck tomorrow and start testing it. I'm like, no, because I've already played this out. I've looked at what's happened over the past, and I can already tell you this scenario. You have a slim and none chance of getting this right, and slim is dead, as my Irish friends used to tell me.
But yeah, so we're at that point then. I'm just looking at your list of items that you said. Talk to me about pre-mortem. What the heck is a pre-mortem?
This is interesting. I started doing this. I teach PMP classes, or I have in the past, probably more than a decade ago. And as part of my own edification, I took an Ishikawa diagram, which is generally used for manufacturing problems. And it's got man, machine, material, and things like that, usually M's. And it's five, I think, and five M's go on it. And I thought, let me think about project management. And I took an Ishikawa diagram and I made it 10 bones to cover the 10 knowledge management areas out of PMI for whatever year that was. And then I thought, Okay, so now I have a, I'm going to say I have, at the, if you're familiar with Ishikawa, it's a root cause analysis exploration, usually. In this case, we're not going to use it as a root cause necessarily. We're going to use it more from for a thinking how things can fail. So at the head, we're not going to put a particular failure symptom we've seen. We're going to put something we think could happen to our project. For example, schedule failure. And I went through the fishbone and I said, okay, can quality make my schedule late? Can, sure, there's a whole bunch of things in quality. Human resources too. Procurement can make my schedule late. Matter of fact, I've seen procurement make a schedule late very frequently. You don't even start on time, so you're bound to finish late. So you end up finding out that these are all kind of gears that intermesh together. And so I started using this in these classes, and we could maybe figure out how to do that in for one of your events, if you'd like, where we can walk through it with some people on board and demonstrate this concept. I didn't think much of it, but I had a professor at a local university contact with me because they were teaching their project management class something about quality, and it was going to Six Sigma. Somebody else did the course for them, and they're like, I don't know that they need to have Six Sigma for entry project management quality. I'm like, no, I don't think so either. And I showed them this, and they were all gung-ho. I think they took it. And I had another discussion with somebody else about this, and they're like, this is very unique. So now I'm like, that's why I put it on here, because I'm like, it is, in fact, in the book, but I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, this is, I learned from it, and my students that I walk through seem to learn something from it. So eventually, when you connect this to the premortem in this regard is I have a symptom. The symptom is I'm over budget or whatever. And then I would go through the knowledge management areas. What things in project management can make me go over budget? If I haven't spent sufficient time decomposing my product or what I'm trying to do, no work breakdown structure at a time when I actually need one. So the scope's not very clear. I don't have a very good controls on my scope, could be a problem. My estimates are poor because they're top down. So if the timing issues are a problem, can make me go over cost. I don't have the right competencies in my human resource and talent section. That can make me late because the guy who can do it in a day, I don't have him. I have the guy who can do it in 2 weeks. That's going to have an impact. I mean, if you go through this, you'll find that all these little things can hit. Some are more likely than others. And those might be the places where you need to pay attention to. In the case of the scope, you want to make sure that you have good controls over, you make sure you have it elicited as clearly as you can at the very beginning, recognizing that things are going to change and that everybody is aware of a change management process for the scope, including the customer and your development team. So you can kind of make sure, create a checklist against these things to kind of answer this eventuality or this possibility.
Looking to the end of your project and going, it's broke. Why is it broke?
Yeah.
This is broke. This is broken on it, yeah.
It's like a scenario-based.
I've seen questions I've had with people talk about doing it kind of in a positive, successfully delivered the project. It's there. It's in there. Everyone, we're on budget. We're on time. Everyone's absolutely.
Yeah.
What stopped us doing that? It's if we were someone who wanted to stop that, we stop it.
Yeah.
Let's put on our nefarious Machiavelli hat and go, right, you don't want to see that. You don't want to see that other version of yourself succeed in that project. So how can you do it? You're the stakeholder. We don't want to. How can we do it? And that is another way you can kind of find those risks, can't you?
Yeah. That leads us to that's a pretty good segue to the other thing. For me, okay, PMI, I'm about to speak some heresy or some blasphemy here, but it is what it is. PMI suggests that there are two dimensions to risks. There's the negative parts and there's the pot. They call it opportunities. And you'll notice in that brief little list I sent you, am I at risk of winning the lottery? I don't really call that a risk. No, and for me, that takes a whole different mindset.
I think the risk of winning, I try to make sure people have got something. I say, right, just in case there's a random bust tonight, and I changed it because I didn't want to tempt fans. So just in case we all win the lottery tonight, yeah, if I win the lottery, I'm not coming back. So yeah, just in case that happens, let's make sure we've got cover. Let's make it.
Okay.
It can be a risk, but it's...
Yeah, that's the approach I can get behind. What you just said, I'm with you, because that is, in fact, a risk. But when you're talking about capitalizing on opportunities, that's not the mindset you want for your risk. You want a naysayer in there. You need to have a little bit of doom and gloom. And then you can sort out what is true and valid or real out of this accordingly. But you want to get as many of the things that somebody in your team can see go wrong. And more importantly, you want to set an atmosphere where they feel like it's okay to do that. Not one where I see something bad can happen, but I don't want to get branded a naysayer or a obstructionist or an Eeyore or whatever. So I'm going to keep my mouth closed. And then the crap hits the fan and that person's just sitting there going, I knew it. And that's not helpful for anybody.
In the danger, how do we kill this?
Yeah.
And you can say silly ideas. Yeah.
No, yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, meteor strike is going to kill the project. Yeah. That's how we could kill this project. Solve them. And once you start getting some of those in, the things that you're talking about where the naysayers being there, it becomes part of the doomsday scenarios that are fun doomsday scenarios to chat about to being daft. But then that allows that open door for them to do that without risk of feeling like they're the doomsayer, because we're going for doomsday prophecies, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. You really need that. And what you just described, every one of the patents, I'm going to say everyone, it's over a pretty good number of years, so it may not exactly be true, but it's probably 95% true, or maybe even higher, maybe 100%, is this. They start with a kernel of somebody saying they're dissatisfied with something or a technical hurdle that needs to be accomplished. And then people start talking about it, probably informally, and these new things come up organically. That's the thing. That's where the diversity is the big deal. You start getting these other perspectives into these discussions, and you start the pieces that you are missing, they fill in, or the pieces that you have right and they have wrong, you start to understand which one of these things is more valid because of circumstances. And it's the same with the risk. You need to have that ability to kind of blurt. And if it's kind of dumb what you're saying, it's not going to cost you anything. It may cost a little bit of joking, but it should be in good fun, like you said here, you know, not the kind of thing that would terminate your participation with the future.
You want to be able to open that for someone to be able to say that. Everyone else go, oh, blooming out, that's a bit doomsayer. That's unlikely, isn't it? One person is going to go, yeah, but it could happen, I suppose, couldn't it?
Yeah.
And because you're all looking at that with a different lens, then everyone goes, oh, it could. What would we do about that then? Well, let's talk about that a bit more. And then it becomes a topic, a subject to discuss.
Yeah. It turns out you can't do anything about it. Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the likelihood really low, but you could potentially be ready for it.
Yeah.
Just think, like, obviously, we talked at the top of the show that you've got this book, your new book. And I was thinking there's got to be, what, 5-6 books on risk management out there? Yeah? There's about 5 or 6 of them on that you can get.
Yeah.
Why write another one?
What
are people get out of your book? Maybe give us a little talk through kind of what's in there and how someone would, your little differentiate, your USP as your product man as well.
yeah. Well, most of them talk about the risk management processes, and I don't think you can't go too far down here without understanding the sequence of things, identifying, doing some kind of assessment, prioritizing things, putting some kind of controlling actions. The difference is not many put a focus on metrics, which are going to be the thing that tells us, is this thing imminent or is it nothing at all to worry about? The other thing is, I've not seen too many risk books that go into the corporate culture that impacts your attitude about risk. Some of the things we just talked about, that also talk about some of the biases that lead us to some conclusions that are kind of end up in very unpleasant situations. Optimism bias, for example, that's just a quick one. There's a lot of those that can end up in, that can put us in a bad place because we weren't paying attention to these things. So it's culture, it's the individual biases. This book also goes into, besides the risk management processes, it goes into practices, Department of Energy practices, automotive practices to reduce risk or to address these risky things, and OSHA kind of actions and security things from IT. It has some, here's practices in these industries. And so if you find yourself like in your automotive industry and you're now messing with vehicles that are connected to telemetry systems that are connected to the world, and cybersecurity is a thing in vehicles. So you can go over there and take a look at, okay, so how does cybersecurity handled it for my automotive? If you want to, if you're in aerospace and you want to adopt some some automotive practices, which might be prudent, I don't know, somebody else would have to make that, then you would learn some things from those as well. So it's not just the processes we go through here. It's all the underlying things, a good number of the underlying things you're going to need in place to be an effective, to have effective risk management. Everything from the metrics and historical record, how to set up so you have a historical record, the problems with measuring things from the individual and from the tools that you use to measure, biases, all these things are going to have an impact on how competent our risk management is.
Industries. And I don't think I've ever sat there consciously. What is the organization that I have done is when I've been in some organizations, they are more risk averse than maybe one of my other colleagues. And I've been cognizant that some projects I've run been a lot more risk averse, been less risk averse than other projects I've run. But I may be doing this, and maybe everyone else is, and I'm like, well, not. But struck me there as kind of at the beginning of your project, whilst doing that risk management, having a conversation about what is our risk appetite on this product, this system we're on, or on this customer experience we might be delivering, the gaming thing you were talking about before. How and I don't know whether you cover that in it, but how do you think about that sort of thing when you're in this situation, if you're studying these projects, and say to someone like, right, okay, the risk management tools, you know, to do that, it's quite hard, but actually, how do you, before that, you need to understand where your boundaries are on your risk appetite. How do you do it?
Yeah. There's a couple of things. The first thing is your strategy selection. Okay, wait a minute. Let's start with the boundaries, because that probably matters first. You sort of have to know the I call it boundary spanning. You sort of have to know the areas internal and external that could probably go wrong or have a chance of going wrong that would produce an outcome you don't like. And for internal, it's maybe not so difficult if you have some historical record, institutional knowledge of the company. For example, I know for a fact where this happens, and then that always, I'm never able to test the truck the next day. It's going to have to be N number of days up to 16 days before it's suitable to be a device to put under test, for example. So some of those things, those scenarios that we've already experienced, are going to help us figure out internally and externally what those boundaries can look like. Legal things change. like regulatory requirements that are up in the air until the last couple of weeks before it's supposed to be in place. Some emissions things happen like that. The government gets involved and they're still trying to figure out, is it A or should it be B? And when your design should essentially be complete, you're still waiting for them to figure this out. So you can't complete the design. So those things, as you experience those, they should go in your register. But here's a good one. The strategy we select is also going to have an impact. For example, there was one of these emissions projects in a company I work at, a vehicle company. And there were two ways to accomplish this objective. One was to add a new electronic control unit and manage the communications between this new thing and the existing vehicle architecture. That's one thing I have to fix, and some communication between it and some other pieces. There was another solution which required gutting essentially the architecture from a communication standpoint and reworking it to the tune of about 80%, maybe more, to match something else. So that now there was a benefit to this. It now meant that instead of having two platforms, I only had one platform. So there was some long-term benefit to this, but there's a big difference between getting one thing right, electronic control unit right, versus whole scale communications change in my vehicle. That's everything has to have to change. And you're up against a clock, ticking clock, that when, you know, January 1 comes rolling around, you're expected to be putting out a particular vehicle to meet this regulatory requirement, legal thing. And so the company could have picked this or that. Want to guess which one they picked? That's exactly what they did. And guess what? They were not shipping vehicles January 1st. You know, and now it might have been worth the gamble. I don't know. I couldn't see that high up into the organization. Maybe the benefit was there. But it seemed to summarily dismiss, let's just add this and create a whole separate project to actually manage this change that matters differently from a timeline, because that's more like a development project, and the time on development project can be like this, you know, fluctuates. But the time on developing an individual component is going to be a lot tighter. In other words, you have a lot more control over that.
Yeah, it's interesting because you can look at those things, and hindsight's great, isn't it? But you can look at that and maybe budget's a different thing, but you sit there and go, well, okay, the optimal is build the proper thing that we've got the reuse, we've got the longer term benefits. So that's great. What's the contingent cost of doing the work? And then that means you can still ship vehicles if it doesn't happen. And then is a cost benefit. Because you duplicate cost, don't you? And at closing, coming towards the end of the call anyway, off really, John. Thank you for your patience waiting. Was that today that you'd like to get over to the team, or maybe there's a single nugget for people when they're thinking about risk management, other than buy your book, what they should think about then?
I'd say spend some time up front, even before you start in that strategy selection. You know, spend some time weighing alternatives. And if you're not the person that's responsible for those, actually weighing those, because sometimes project managers are not, some executives do that, and then you get your marching orders in some companies. That's how it works. You know, this is what we're going to do. At least push back a little bit to let them know if there's some other strategy that, or some reasons the strategy might not be the best, you know, help coach them through that, coach upward in this case, because they probably don't know. And then the next thing I'd say is do some scenario work, spend some time with your team working out scenarios of things that can go wrong. Use a pre-mortem. You don't have to use the Ishikawa, but do some kind of thinking about what can go wrong. Look at your historical record. If you don't have a historical record, but you've got plenty of people on your team with experience within your organization or even outside, let's listen to that. Let's get that on deck and then figure out which ones of those are the most egregious and find some metrics to track these things, or find some ways to get rid of them altogether if you can. It happens long before we start doing the work. Your project risk management should ideally start long before you do the work, but don't let it stop at the beginning either. You know, emerging things happen. So spend, you know, just make it part of your ritual. Besides this upfront work, just make it part of your cadence of your project, and set a tone so your team members will bring you stuff before it's a trauma. Hey, we got a risk. Oh no, what you're describing right now seems to be an actual problem, not a potential problem.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it is a case of, I know with we had risk management systems at one time where we encouraged our teams to put risks in and they didn't. Partially because I think the way that we did it, and I love the idea of that continuity of not just doing the update the risk register, which, as you can tell, I don't have a lot of time for, but actually, you've got little things firing out of my head on there, and the idea of doing that pre-mortem. And doing that pre-mortem activity when you've got a long-running piece of work to do it regular, but also have that as part of your, if you're doing daily stand-ups, if you're doing weekly calls or whatever, as part of that, not go through, right, let's review our risks, let's have a look what we've written in it. Not that crap. It's kind of, what else can stop us? What have we found that might stop us? What might stop us? What might stop us? And have that sort of... In playing football or soccer or anything like that, you kind of think of it and think that all the way through a game of soccer, the team are watching to see what's the risk of the goal of someone getting to a position that may mean that they can get the goal, and they're trying to get it and they're calling to their colleagues to go and deal with it. And I don't think we encourage that kind of basis within projects, and we could do. And that kind of being able to drop in and go, I've spotted time.
Yeah. Yeah, more of an ongoing attitude toward it. Yeah,
it is that, and the same with everything in projects. We then move to get stuff done and tick off it's done, which just doesn't always help us. As I say, thank you so much for coming on the show. If people want to get a hold of the book, want to get in touch with you, want to find out more about you and what you do, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, connect with me on LinkedIn, John M. Quigley on LinkedIn. You can send me an email at john.quigley@valuetransform.com. The book is on Amazon, so you can get it there.
Cool.
That should do it. Okie dokie. Thanks for having me on, Nigel.
Okay, you're the first one on there. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you.
Bye.
Yeah, thank you. Later, brother.
Another great sponsor of the show comes in the form of Air Manual. Air Manual is it's a tool for documenting process, which and best practices. It's a company formed by a guy, one of my interviewees, Alexis Kingsbury. And I kind of summarized why my view of where we see documentation, a lot of my experience has been people will document something. Process, they'll put it in a Visio diagram that gets loaded onto a SharePoint site or something similar, and then a bunch of that. So then once that diagram's been shared with senior management, they're happy they have a process in the business. But then the detailed procedures underneath it might be with documents in just poorly kept and not linked easily and not updated. And what Air Manual does, it allows you to put in it's a tool for doing this kind of thing. You whack it in, the service in there, get in there, put in your process, your flow, and you build it down to as low a level of detail, even to the point of checklists where people can check off they've done it. So it creates that guided checklists
easy to create, easy to maintain, and all in one place. And no one's kind of rooting around to find the SharePoint. And then when you change to new SharePoint services and all that stuff, it's all there. So if you pop along to nigelpriester.com/airmanual, there's a bit more detail there and a link there to click on to go and get, I think they offer a trial and things like that. So it's something that I think can easily reduce the amount of errors, rework, etc. within our organisation. So yeah, take a look. So this is my final wrap up. Every week you're going to hear this, you're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listened to this podcast to the end of this show and you think that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nigel out. There are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast, send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links, or send them to www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts, and that'll push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreaser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics. I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there, somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well. And I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye. My latest, the latest affiliate that I've got on the show now is Riverside. I use Riverside to do my interviews, Riverside FM. It kind of offers you a whole, if you like, micro studio management producer tool, and goes beyond that. Has a really good free layer, and I've been using it for a while now. I find it really good. When I've had issues, even though I'm not on one of the higher paid levels, the support has been quick, responsive, and of high quality, and people keen to help me. The organisation seems really good. The product seems really intuitive. And quality is really good as well. And it's a clever way of doing it is when you're recording through your browsers, so you've not got loads of desktop resources being used compared to some other products that I've used. And what they also do is they do they stream a lower quality version of it up onto as you're doing the interview, so you're not burning bandwidth while you're doing the interview and potentially impacting on the quality of the conversation. And then at the end, it uploads it, the higher quality from your browser. I mean, it's just a really good way of doing it. So If you are thinking of doing a podcast and there's someone's doing a podcast, I would recommend using this tool. I found it really good. Best of the tools that I've tried using to date. And you can get that at nigelcreaser.com/riverside, and that will redirect you to my kickback page on their site, and there I will get a little kickback from them. So take a look. Thanks.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.